a united church is a wonderful thing. It's one reason why I get us all together like this at least four times a year, so we can enjoy not being Kemsing 9:15, Kemsing 10:30, and Woodlands, but worshipping together, being one. For a congregation to be united is a wonderful thing. For a pair of local churches to be united is a wonderful thing. It's one reason why I decided we would look together at John chapter 17 during our combined services. Many people would say that this is a chapter all about unity. As I've studied it, I'm not convinced that unity is the only theme of this chapter, or even that it's the main theme of the chapter, but it's certainly a pretty major one. So verse 11, so that they may be one as we are one. Verse 21, that all of them may be one. Verse 22, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. It's an immensely attractive picture, and John 17 is one passage that will tell us how to get there, and some other things along the way. But I take it we all want real unity. So much that passes for church unity is fake, sham. Churches find a statement they can all agree on, but only because they mean different things by the words in the statement. A unity that is about not letting our disagreements bubble over too much into public. That's not real unity. How do we build real unity, lasting unity, deep unity? And the answer is with great care. We need to get the foundations right if the building is to stand up. Which means we need to follow everything Jesus says in this chapter carefully and put it into practice. It won't do simply to spot that Jesus wants his church to be one, chop that out of the Bible, close the Bible, and stick it on a calendar or on a meme, and just tell each other not to be so disagreeable. We've got to lay the foundations and do it right. When we finally get to build our church hall, it will need good foundations. Dig down deep. Build something solid. And the other really important thing is the first brick you lay. If it goes in the ground at slightly the wrong angle, the entire building would be wonky. The surveyors amongst you are smiling, probably because you've seen it happen. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20 says that the church is like a building. The stone at the corner, the cornerstone, that's Jesus himself. The foundations are the apostles and prophets, the people who wrote the Bible. The apostles wrote the New Testament. The prophets wrote the Old Testament. That's Ephesians 2. We get the same thing here in John 17. The chapter falls into three sections. Verses 1 to 5 were about Jesus. We looked at those in our combined services last year, probably too far ago to remember. He's the cornerstone. He finished the work he came to do when he died on the cross. He has returned to the glory he had before the world began. Now everyone can know him and so know God and so have life. The cornerstone, then we get the foundations, the apostles. You'll see that our Bibles give verses 6 to 19 a heading. Jesus prays for his disciples. As distinct from verses 20 to 26, Jesus prays for all believers. The headings are right. Verse 6, Jesus is praying for those whom you gave me out of the world. And in verse 20, Jesus' prayer changes. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. So 20 to 26, all believers down the ages, people like us. But first we get 6 to 19, the first generation of disciples. Jesus is laying the foundations. So here's the big point. a united church must be built on the foundation of the apostles. That's Jesus' first disciples, Peter, James, John, nine others with less memorable names. Then add James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul. If we learn our Christianity from them, if the Jesus we follow is the one they taught, then we are on the way to being a healthy and united church of the kind Jesus prayed for here. But why then? What's so special about those men that we must learn our Jesus from them? And what does this all mean in practice? Why then? For today, two answers as to why then. I'll dig out some more in July when we next gather all together. Answer number one, because they were given to Jesus. They were given to Jesus. Who by? By God the Father. In this passage, we get a wonderful insight into the character of God the Father. He is first and foremost a giver. Verse 7, everything you have given me, says Jesus, comes from you. In verse 11, the Father gave Jesus his name. In verse 8, the Father gave Jesus all the words he was to teach. I gave them the words you gave me. And amongst all the other gifts that the Father has given to his Son, there is one more gift, the gift of the disciples. Verse 6, I have revealed you to those whom you gave me out of the world. They were yours, you gave them to me, and they have obeyed your word. And again in verse 9, I am not praying for the world, but for those you have given me, for they are yours. Those disciples belonged to God the Father, long before Jesus came along. And then God the Father gave them to Jesus to be his. There was nothing special in them that meant they were the ones chosen. Verse 6, they were given to Jesus out of the world. The word world in John refers to us as we organize ourselves to rebel against God. Just like the rest of us, these first disciples were rebels against God, part of the world, until, totally by grace, God the Father gave them out of the world to Jesus. And you can see that God has chosen them, given them to Jesus, by the way they responded to him. They responded in trust and obedience. So we are watching the Father's gift work itself out in practice. Trust and obedience. Trust comes in verse 8. I gave them the words you gave me. They accepted them. They knew with certainty I came from you, and they believed that you sent me. Obedience comes in verse 6, you gave them to me, and they have obeyed your word. Not perfectly. As we read John, we've watched the disciples stumble around, frequently confused by Jesus, often missing the point. But in terms of their response to Jesus overall, they have indeed trusted and obeyed him. Compare that to the crowd. Plenty of people followed Jesus superficially, but they would always drift away. Take John 6, the feeding of the 5,000. That is a big crowd. That is the whole of Kemsing. The chapter starts with that huge crowd following Jesus. As he talks to them, they discover what he's really about. They leave, one group after another, and by the end, just the 12 are left. John chapter 6, verse 67. You do not want to leave too, do you? Jesus asked the 12. Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God. The disciples weren't perfect, But compared to everyone else in their day, they believed, they obeyed. So we can see that they are the ones the Father has given to Jesus. Back to what we're talking about. This means they are the ones we need to listen to. See, here's our problem. We have to hear about Jesus secondhand. There's no way around that. He's not here on earth anymore. You can't go to a meeting at the Royal Albert Hall in which Jesus will physically appear and speak to you. And when you hear something secondhand, you always wonder whether you've heard the right version of things. You read about something that happened, and it's easy to dismiss it as, well, that's what you'd expect the Daily Mail to say, or the Daily Telegraph, or the Guardian, or whichever paper it was. That's typical of the BBC. You suspect that if you'd read a different paper that had talked to different sources, there might be a rather different spin on things. So take that awful chemical attack in Syria at the start of the month. Remember that? Mostly, we were told, this was a direct attack by the Syrian government. But other people suggested this was an accident when a chemical store was hit by one or other side. Others suggested the rebels deliberately staged it to look like a government assault. There is truth out there, but it can be hard to find out. And so often it depends who you talk to. Which group of people will give you not just their version of events, but the true version. Now here's the thing. There's only one Jesus. There is only one Jesus. But out of all of his contemporaries, who should we be listening to? Making sure we are meeting the real one. Might we get a different version of events if we asked a different editor, if they spoke to different witnesses? How do we know that the 12 disciples are the ones to give us the true version of events? And the answer is, they are the ones that God the Father handpicked to be the eyewitnesses of all that would take place. And having chosen them, he gave them to Jesus. And we can see that they were given them to him because they believed and they obeyed, which nobody else did at this stage. They were given to Jesus. That's the first reason why these are the men we must listen to if we want to meet the real Jesus, if we want to build a church on the kind of foundation that brings real unity. The second reason is this. They were taught by Jesus. They were taught by Jesus. We get that a couple of times in these verses. Verse 6, I have revealed you to those whom you gave me out of the world. Or if you look at the footnote in our Bibles, I have revealed your name to those whom you gave me out of this world. Jesus has revealed the Father to them. In Bible thinking, someone's name is another way of saying their character. He's not just revealed the Father's name, he's revealed who he is and what his plans and purposes are. Not that his name is irrelevant. Read these verses, you see that Jesus has revealed his Father's name. His name is Father. He is the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He prays to him as Father. In verse 1. He does it again in verse 11, where it becomes Holy Father. He is the giver who gives all good things to his Son, who gives to Jesus, God the Son, all that he has. These men were taught by God. Jesus revealed the Father's name. We also get that in verse 8. I gave them the words you gave me, and they accepted them. Jesus has passed on to these men the very words that the Father gave to him to instruct them. That's why verse 6 says, you gave them to me, and they have obeyed your word. As Jesus has instructed these men, they have obeyed. And it is the Father's word they have obeyed. They've been taught by Jesus. They've been taught about God's purposes, how Jesus fulfills them. They've been let into the secret of what God is doing. They've been given the very words that the Father wanted passing to them. You see, we don't only want to know whether this particular group of men were the ones
God the Father wanted to tell us about Jesus, we also need to know if they know what they're talking about. Have they had their proper training? I'm sure you've all had experiences with people who were not properly trained. Maybe a shop assistant demonstrating how to use something when it's clear they barely know themselves. And if you ask them anything that's not on their sales pitch script, they are completely lost. You wonder if they even have a washing machine at home. What a contrast when you phone up to get help with your broadband and you discover, as I did, that you're talking to someone in the UK who really knows how it all works and they can properly help. Or when you're staying in a hotel and every member of staff you ask knows exactly what to do if you ask for their help with something. They've had thorough training. We had to have our tumble dryer fixed a while back. The engineer who came was from an older generation of engineers, and he and I talked about how in the old days the manufacturers would train the engineers carefully on one model several days, take it apart, put it back together. Then the next model several days, months of thorough training on machine after machine after machine. Exactly how it works, what goes wrong, how to fix it. Jesus' disciples, you see, they're not untrained shop assistants. He has spent 3 years with them, passing on everything the Father wanted them to know. He can truly say, I have revealed your name to those whom you gave me. They're not in the dark, they're enlightened. When they speak about Jesus, they really do know what they're talking about. There's more we can say from these verses about what makes these disciples so special. Why must we learn about Jesus from them? But we've seen two reasons for this morning. Because, number one, they were given to Jesus by the Father. The men that God the Father wanted to be the ones to pass the message on. And number two, because they were taught by Jesus, shown the ropes, initiated, enlightened. So what? What does all this mean in practice? It means if you want a church that is built for unity, you have to have the right foundations. That means the apostles, Jesus' first disciples, which means we need the New Testament, all of it. It needs to be the foundation of our life as a church if we are ever to see the kind of unity that Jesus wants us to have. Don't mishear me. I'm not dismissing the Old Testament. We need that too. But today's text is talking about the New Testament. For many Christians and for many churches, the New Testament is a book that sits on the shelf. We rarely open it. We don't really know what's in it, apart from the four Gospels and selected bits of those at that. The New Testament we have is the collection of documents that the early church could see were written by the actual apostles. It's why they kept the documents they did, and it's why they tossed the documents they didn't keep. We know because we have the minutes of the meetings at which they discussed this. The New Testament is how we get to listen to that select group given to Jesus, taught by Jesus, that we might encounter Jesus as he wanted us to encounter him. So we need to read it, learn it, study it, hear it, taught and explained, apply it, and above all, live it. Including the bits that feel more unfamiliar, like Hebrews and bits of Revelation. Especially the bits that feel more unfamiliar, like Hebrews and bits of Revelation. When was the last time you read Hebrews or Revelation? Including the bits that don't sit comfortably with what we might already think, like Romans chapter 1 or 1 Timothy chapter 2. Especially the bits that don't sit comfortably with what we might already think, like Romans chapter 1 or 1 Timothy chapter 2. If there are bits of the New Testament that we don't know very well or that make us feel uncomfortable, we can't just put our heads in the sand. That would be to move off the solid foundation. That would be to move away from unity as a church. We need to build our lives and the life of our church on the 27 documents that make up the New Testament. Now, that alone won't make for a united church. But it is the foundation, and without it, we are not even starting in the right place, and I guarantee we won't be a united church without that. So, a united church would be a wonderful thing. It allows us to demonstrate to the world how good it is when Jesus takes charge of human society. Let's build for that. Let's build our life on the Jesus these first disciples have to show us. And just while we're here, if any of you here have not yet discovered Jesus for yourself, please join us in discovering him. Speak to me. I can put you in touch with a group that's about to start and looking at this. But start right here in Matthew, Mark, Luke, jot through to Revelation. Because this Jesus really is most wonderful.